This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. Beginning with Forbes magazine, the first family fortunes. Donald Trump just had the most lucrative year of his life, but percentage-wise, his immediate family has done even better. Jimmy Carter's brother Billy promoted Billy Beer and took cash from the Libyans. Richard Nixon had his brother Donald's phone tapped amid concerns about business dealings. The United States has a long history of presidential relatives looking to cash in on their connections to the commander-in-chief. But no president, or extended family, has used the office to profit as successfully as the Trumps. Family members who never had significant fortunes, Eric, Don Jr., Barron, and Melania, have accumulated tens, then hundreds of millions of dollars over the last 12 months, boosting the Trump family fortune to nearly $10 billion. Their primary vehicle for enrichment? Cryptocurrency. Teaming up with his three sons, Donald Trump announced a crypto venture in September 2024 named World Liberty Financial, which initially struggled to gain traction. Then he won the White House. After the election, crypto entrepreneur Justin's son, whom Joe Biden's Securities and Exchange Commission had accused of fraud the previous year, invested $75 million in World Liberty Financial, routing an estimated $40 million to the president-elect and $16 million more to his family members, kickstarting a powerful engine. In January, days before re-entering the White House, Donald and Melania Trump each launched separate meme coins, $Trump and $Melania, handing the couple hundreds of millions of dollars. Once in office, Trump rolled back regulatory enforcement of crypto and signed legislation favorable to the industry, ensuring he and his family would personally benefit. His meme coins, initially tied up for 3 months, now unlock daily, freeing tens of millions per week. World Liberty Financial, meanwhile, has continued selling tokens, largely to anonymous buyers, generating an estimated $1.4 billion so far. A Trump family entity receives a roughly 75% cut of those sales, amounting to more than $1 billion. Outside of the cryptoverse, Trump has deployed his cash conservatively. He paid off $114 million of debt against 40 Wall Street, a troubled New York skyscraper, at the start of the summer. In July, he knocked out a couple of smaller loans, totaling some $15 million against mansions in New York and Florida. He also loaded up on municipal and corporate bonds. Trump's balance sheet is now stronger than ever, with an estimated $1.1 billion of liabilities and $8.4 billion of assets, $1.1 billion of which are in liquid holdings. Almost everything in his portfolio is doing well. Trump's real estate licensing business, stalled out for years, has come roaring back to life with new deals in Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, Romania, India, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Its revenue jumped an estimated 580% in 2024 to $45 million, boosting the value of the business by $400 million. In the United States, the president's golf and club portfolio continues to thrive, as profits rose an estimated 30% last year, adding about $325 million to Trump's net worth. Appellate judges in New York threw out a roughly $500 million fraud penalty in August. With so much money coming in, the Trumps may soon get back to their first love, building. They have been making noise for years about constructing small villages at their golf resorts in Scotland and Florida. Projects like that require a lot of liquidity, something they've never always had. But now, after reclaiming the White House and cashing in on the power that comes with it, the Trumps can pretty much do anything they want. Here's a sidebar. Donald's dynasty. President Trump's dad, Fred, got rich building 20,000 apartments across New York City. Donald joined Fred's firm in 1968. From the outset, he was ruthless. His first quote in the inaugural Forbes 400 from 1982, when he and his father were listed together, worth a combined $200 million, $660 million in today's money. Quote, man is the most vicious of all animals, and life is a series of battles ending in victory or defeat, close quote. Decades later, his family is still monetizing those killer instincts. Another sidebar, Donald and Melania Trump, net worth $7.3 billion, $20 million plus. Trump's fortune jumped $3 billion in 1 year. That 70% gain vaulted him 118 spots on the Forbes 400, where he lands this year at number 201. His move into crypto accounts for $2 billion of that, split more or less evenly between World Liberty Financial and the meme coin. A New York appeals court gave him a $500 million boost by throwing out his civil fraud penalty, and another $400 million comes from the explosion of his international licensing business. Melania has made money in typical First Lady ways, books, speeches, a documentary, and unquestionably Trumpian ways, launching a meme coin of her own, which has a current market cap of $50 million. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, worth $1 billion, $100 million. In January 2021, the same month his father-in-law first left the White House, Kushner founded a private equity firm, Affinity Partners, leveraging the relationships he'd built as a presidential advisor. Kushner raised $4.6 billion from backers in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, and has invested more than $2 billion in 22 companies. The firm is valued at an estimated $215 million. Thanks in part to Affinity's war chest, plus his 20% stake, worth $560 million, in his family's real estate firm, Kushner Companies. Kushner is now a billionaire. It also helps that the value of the couple's home on Miami's elite Indian Creek Island, where neighbors include Jeff Bezos, has more than tripled in value since they bought it in 2020. Donald Trump Jr. is worth $500 million. Don Jr. holds a smaller stake in American Bitcoin and serves as a co-founder of World Liberty. He and Eric set up a special purpose acquisition corporation in August that's on the hunt for merger targets in tech, health care, or logistics. He's also a big player in the anti-woke economy, partnering with self-described, quote, anti-ESG, close quote, venture firm 1789 Capital, and holding board seats at anti-woke, anti-abortion online marketplace Public Square, online firearm retailer Grab a Gun, and Truth Social's parent company. Eric Trump is worth $800 million. The president's second son has made more money on crypto than any of his siblings. Most of it comes from American Bitcoin, a crypto mining venture he co-founded in March that went public in early September, briefly making him a billionaire. Some of the hype has faded, but Eric's 7.5% stake is still worth an estimated $550 million. He also got an estimated 10% cut of World Liberty Financial token sales. With his older brother, Don Jr., he traveled to the Middle East in May, where he signed a deal to license the family name on a golf resort in Qatar, among other new ventures. As of July 2024, the brothers apparently split 20% of the profits from certain licensing deals. And finally, Barron Trump is worth $150 million. The president's youngest child was all in on crypto long before his dad and helped coax the family to co-found World Liberty Financial. Quote, he's got four wallets or something, and I'm saying, what is a wallet? Close quote. Trump chuckled last September at World Liberty's launch. So far, the 19-year-old New York University sophomore has pocketed an estimated $80 million and still holds an estimated $2.3 billion locked up tokens, which Forbes heavily discounts because they can't yet be traded. If the current price hangs on long enough, he might be able to dump them for $450 million when they unlock. Continuing in Forbes magazine, bigger, richer, and untamed, South Park's equal opportunity offenders have insulted their way to 10-figure fortunes. Piss off South Park creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone, and they'll make you pay, both financially and satirically. This summer, after Comedy Central delayed the show's season 27 premiere because Paramount, the network's parent company, was locked in contentious negotiations with Parker and Stone for streaming rights, In the midst of the months-long acquisition of Paramount by David Ellis and Skydance Media, the duo let it rip on X. Quote, this merger is a shit show, close quote, they wrote, quote, and it's fucking up South Park, close quote. Everything was much better by late July when Parker and Stone agreed to a 5-year, $1.5 billion streaming deal that will bring South Park to Paramount Plus globally. That same week, the FCC officially approved the Skydance acquisition. The deal cemented the pair's place as the highest-paid TV showrunners in Hollywood and made billionaires of Parker, who was 55, and Stone, who was 54, who are worth an estimated $1.2 billion each. But the new agreement, which will pay the pair at least $250 million per year, didn't end Paramount's headaches. The season premiere depicted Donald Trump in bed with Satan, with Jesus warning the show's young protagonists about the dangers of provoking the president. Quote, you guys saw what happened to CBS. Well, guess who owns CBS? Paramount, close quote, Jesus says. Quote, you really want to end up like Stephen Colbert? Close quote. The comedically fearless Parker and Stone now enter television's rare billionaire creative class, joining Oprah Winfrey, Tyler Perry, Dick Wolf, and Jerry Seinfeld in the three-comma club. That astonishing amount of money is a testament to the enduring popularity of South Park, which has been a phenomenon since its debut on Comedy Central in 1997. Over the years, it became indispensable to the network, and its 300-plus episodes are now bulk inventory that re-air dozens of times weekly. Parker and Stone will produce 10 new episodes of South Park each year until 2030, and there's little doubt that will continue to mock both their parent company and the litigious president. When asked at Comic-Con in July what to expect from the rest of the season, Stone quipped, quote-unquote, no politics. As for the fit Trump pitched over the first episode, Parker was likewise deadpan. Quote, we're terribly sorry, close quote. Here's a sidebar. My first investment, Richard Branson, net worth $2.8 billion. Purchase Christmas trees. Sir Richard's long and eccentric line of entrepreneurial ventures began at age 13 when he and a mate thought they spotted a surefire way to get rich, Christmas trees. Using pocket money, they bought a bag of seeds for £5, figuring they could sell 400 evergreens once they grew to 4 feet for a tidy profit of £795. They didn't make a penny. Most were eaten by rabbits. Quote, I quickly discovered that money doesn't grow on trees, close quote, Branson quips. The following Christmas, they tried again, this time with a scheme to breed budgerigars, the small long-tailed parrots that were semi-popular as pets. Branson's father built them an aviary and the birds quickly multiplied. Quote, we overestimated the local demands for budgies, close quote, Branson recalls. Quote, even after everyone I knew had bought two, we still had lots left, close quote. One day, his mother told him the aviary had been invaded by rats. Years later, she confessed that she'd been fed up with cleaning it and set the birds free. While neither of these ventures amounted to much, Branson says they taught him valuable lessons about perseverance. Quote, failure isn't a dead end, it's simply part of the journey, close quote. And taking calculated risks, quote, I still believe in making bold decisions, but I've learned to protect the downside, close quote. Moving on to Barron's, Trump tariffs are on the block. Axing them would have unexpected market consequences. And five other things to know today. Hope for an end to the government shutdown as it enters day 37. Robinhood's revenue doubles. And more news to start your day. Markets have largely taken trade levies in their stride, but the Supreme Court could add a new twist to the tariff drama, and that will have a mixed impact. The justices scrutinized the Trump administration's case for tariffs, and after a session of tough questioning, the market's conclusion was clear. The president's key trade and foreign policy is at risk. Above all, the Supreme Court looks to be leaning toward the orthodox economic position that tariffs are a tax on consumers and businesses and therefore under the authority of Congress. Removing taxes is normally a good thing for stocks. The effective tariff rate stands at around 18%. If those imposed under President Donald Trump's economic emergency declaration are removed, that rate would drop to around 9%, according to the Yale Budget Lab. But it's not clear that a Supreme Court intervention would be a straightforward boost to the market. And the reason for that is Trump is very unlikely to abandon tariffs, especially with a growing threat that the Democrats could take back the House in 2026 and block much of his legislative program. The result would be months of uncertainty as Trump uses alternative legislation to justify import taxes addressing both specific sectors and countries. Meanwhile, the prospect of the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates could be complicated by new calculations around tariff-driven inflation. There will still be a few celebrations if the Supreme Court does strike down the current tariff regime. Automakers and small-cap stocks could be in line for a boost amid a rotation away from increasingly stretched large-cap tech companies. But the drama could become too much for some investors if the latest tariff episode takes a troubling turn. That was written by Adam Clark. President's policy faces uncertainty after Supreme Court grilling. President Donald Trump's sweeping tariffs appear at least somewhat vulnerable to being struck down. After some of the Supreme Court's conservative justices probed the Trump administration's view of the emergency powers Trump relied on to impose the levies on goods from around the world. The justices spent 3 hours examining the text of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act as it considers whether Trump had improperly seized for himself Congress's sole power to tax. Conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett and Chief Justice John Roberts expressed doubts about the government's arguments. While the government has argued that tariffs are part of the president's foreign affairs powers, Chief Justice Roberts appeared to agree with the liberal justices that tariffs are a form of taxation on Americans, a power that belongs to Congress rather than the president. The prediction site Polymarket judged that the arguments went poorly for the government and Solicitor General D. John Sauer. Before oral arguments started, Polymarket put a 36% chance of the government winning its case. By the end of the arguments, that had faded to about 30%. Rick Waldenberg's Learning Resources, an educational toy company that sued to challenge the administration's tariffs, is navigating the current situation by buying fewer goods from China, scaling back expansion plans, cutting costs, and holding off on hiring needed workers. What's next? The Supreme Court could take months to release its decision. The businesses that are challenging the tariffs would need at least 5 judges agreeing with them to win a favorable outcome. That could mean 2 Republican-appointed justices, there are 6, joining all 3 appointed by Democrats. Government shutdown, waiting for a break in the impasse. At 37 days, the government shutdown is history's longest, but there could be a breakthrough coming soon by lawmakers. Policy analysts see the end in sight by Thanksgiving, but there may be pain along the way, especially for air travelers. Regulators will begin cutting flight capacity at airports on Friday. Pressure to end the shutdown will grow as Tuesday's Democratic election sweep fades from memory and disruptions to air travel continue to increase, according to Evercore ISI analysts. Prediction markets Kalshi and Polymarket see it ending next week. Around 1.4 government employees are on unpaid leave or working without pay. Millions of Americans face cuts to benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It all could shave 1 percentage point off gross domestic product for the 4th quarter and push the unemployment above 4.5%, analyst David Rosenberg said. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said he would cut 10% of flight capacity at 40 airports starting Friday if the shutdown doesn't end. The affected airports to be announced today will be in high-traffic environment markets, Federal Aviation Administration Chief Brian Bedford said. They called it a quote-unquote proactive move. Flight delays have been a persistent problem in recent weeks as the shutdown has dragged on. Air traffic controllers must show up for their jobs but aren't getting paid. They have missed 1 paycheck so far and will miss another one in the coming days if the government shutdown continues. What's next? The Democratic election victories could strengthen lawmakers' resolve not to budge on ending the shutdown until their demand that health care plan subsidies are extended is met. Stiefel policy strategist Brian Gardner wrote that the chances of a shutdown lasting have increased. Qualcomm and Arm Holdings beat expectations, raised guidance. Qualcomm beat expectations and highlighted its new artificial intelligence accelerator chips and servers, which it expects to provide material revenue in 2027. It's a long road for them to make a big dent in Qualcomm's financials. The first job is convincing customers to forego the industry standard, NVIDIA. The chipmaker reported an adjusted earnings of $3 a share in its fiscal fourth quarter, with revenue rising 10% to $11.27 billion. The highlight of the fourth quarter was chip revenue at $9.8 billion, and all three categories, core smartphone chips, automotive, and Internet of Things, beat expectations. First quarter guidance for earnings of $3.30 to $3.50 a share and revenue of $11.8 billion to $12.6 billion also beat Wall Street projections, but expense growth exceeded expectations, and the outlook for automotive chip sales was soft, made up for in other parts of the business. Separately, ARM Holdings also beat expectations. The chip designer reported adjusted September quarter earnings of 39 cents a share, and revenue jumped more than 34% to $1.14 billion. It is forecasting current quarter revenue at a midpoint of $1.225 billion. UK-based ARM licenses its chip designs to chip and smartphone makers such as Apple and Qualcomm. ARM's latest advanced chip technology, called ARMv9, generates higher royalty rates than its previous ARMv8. It is also making progress in the high-end cloud server processor market. Continuing in parents, fast casual restaurants are expanding fast. Can sales catch up? The main concern for Wingstop and Cava is the slowdowns of same restaurant sales growth, yet both have lofty valuations. Fast casual restaurant chains are opening new stores at an aggressive pace. Whether they can copy the success of their existing stores will be key to a rebound in their stock prices. Wingstop, a chicken wing chain with nearly 3,000 locations, and Cava Group, which offers casual Mediterranean meals at more than 400 stores, differ widely both in scale and their menus. But the two have one thing in common. Both have grown their store footprint by nearly 20% over the past 12 months. In the latest quarter, ending in September, Wingstop opened 114 net new restaurants, marking the fifth consecutive quarter of more than 100 new openings. That aggressive pace has brought its store count up 19% over the past year to nearly 3,000. The momentum will likely continue. With a swelling pipeline of franchise commitments, Wingstop expects unit growth in the mid-teens range for 2026. The chain aims to expand by at least 10% annually, eventually reaching 10,000 restaurants globally. Likewise, Cava added 74 new restaurants over the past four quarters, boosting its total footprint by 18% to 415 across the nation. The majority of the new openings were in suburban areas as the chain aims to tap the rising appetite among the middle class for ethnic food. Cava plans to grow its restaurant count by 18.5% to 19% this year, followed by growth of at least 16% in 2026. Management aims to reach 1,000 restaurants by 2032. Whether they can achieve the targeted scale would be key to Wingstop and Cava's share prices. Both stocks have tumbled over the past year as investors became cautious of their high-flying valuations. As of Monday's close, before the companies posted their third-quarter earnings results, Wingstop stock was down 25%, while Cava had declined 53%. Cava's company's sales increased only 2% year-over-year in the past two quarters. There are signs of a plateau. In the September quarter, the company said growth was primarily from higher menu prices, while guest traffic was roughly flat. Things are even more concerning at Wingstop, where same-store sales declined 5.6% in the third quarter, following a 1.9% slip in the previous 3 months. Wingstop management believes the headwinds should be temporary. The chain has been rolling out quote-unquote smart kitchen, which uses automation and digital tools to make ordering, cooking, and delivery faster and more efficient. The system has been in place in over 2,000 restaurants and is on track to reach all domestic locations by year-end. Restaurants with smart kitchen consistently deliver a 10-minute speed of service, which is 50% faster than before, the company said. Along with a new marketing campaign and renewed loyalty program, this should attract more customers and boost the chain's average unit volume, annual sales per location, from current $2 million to the long-term goal of $3 million, management said. Raymond James analyst Brian Vaccaro noted that comparable sales at Wingstop's company-operated stores were up 3.8% from a year ago in the third quarter, outperforming franchise stores by over 9 percentage points. This could be, quote, at least partially due to the benefits of Smart Kitchen, close quote, he said. Investors seem positive for now. Despite the decline of same-store sales posted on Tuesday, Wingstop stock jumped 15% from Monday's close. At CAVA, the average unit volume is already at $2.9 million. As the chain opens more restaurants in suburbs across the nation, maintaining that level would be important. Fast casual menus generally have higher prices than fast food. Investors would watch whether a CAVA bowl, usually priced at nearly $15, remains appealing to a wider population. So far, it looks promising. CEO Brett Schulman noted that CAVA's 2025 new restaurants have an average unit volume of more than $3 million, similar to, if not better than, existing stores. This is, quote, clear proof of the brand's portability and resonance across the country, close quote, he said. Quote, the underlying strength of our model is evident, close quote. Quote, the robust performance of new units in both new and existing markets speak to the ultimate opportunity for CAVA to become a much larger brand relative to its 400-plus units today, close quote, wrote William Blair analyst Sharon Zackfia in a Wednesday note. Restaurant chains feel the squeeze as customers pinch pennies. Restaurants that cater to lower-income consumers are underperforming higher-priced eateries. It's another sign of the economy's bifurcation. This is written by Megan Leonhardt. The U.S. economy is poised to grow by just under 2% this year on an inflation-adjusted basis, but the headline number obscures a bifurcated picture. Higher-income consumers continue to spend, if a bit less freely than earlier this year, while lower-income households are pulling back. The disparity is evident in the most recent restaurant industry trends, which show full-service dining establishments doing better than fast-food eateries. The split is likely to persist so long as the job market continues to weaken and inflation stays high, pinching the pockets of lower-income consumers disproportionately. Restaurant sales declined by an average of 2.2% a week in the 4 weeks through October 26th, according to Bloomberg's second measure alternative data analytics, which draw on credit and debit card transactions. That compares to an average drop of 1.1% a week in the 4 weeks through September 28th. Sales at full-service restaurants, which typically command higher price points, were down by an average of 1.4% a week in the 4 weeks through October 26th, according to the Bloomberg data. But limited service eateries, which include fast food restaurants, saw an average weekly drop of 2.5% during the same period. Stock market gains and real estate equity are helping America's richer households. A recent YouGov consumer research survey found that 44% of lower-income respondents reported eating out less frequently now than a year ago, compared with 27% of higher-income respondents. McDonald's, for example, has been hurt as customers have scaled back. Sales were down by an average of 15.8% a week in the 4 weeks through October 26th, based on the Bloomberg data. The fast food giant with about 13,700 U.S. stores failed to beat earnings and revenue forecasts in its third quarter, according to the company's latest quarterly earnings report released Wednesday. Shares were down 1.7% in midday trading Thursday and have fallen almost 4% year-to-date. CEO Chris Kempczinski said Wednesday that the chain continues to see a, quote, bifurcated consumer base with traffic from lower-income consumers declining nearly double digits in the third quarter, a trend that's persisted for nearly 2 years, close quote. But McDonald's has seen higher-income customers increase by nearly double digits in the quarter, Kempczinski said during the company's earnings call. Chipotle Mexican Grill's interim CEO, Scott Boatwright, similarly cited consumer headwinds, even though the burrito chain's latest quarterly earnings met expectations. Quote, earlier this year, as consumer sentiment declined sharply, we saw a broad-based pullback in frequency across all income cohorts, close quote, Boatwright said during an analyst call on October 29th. Quote, since then, the gap has widened with low to middle income guests further reducing frequency, close quote. Consumers making less than $100,000 represent about 40% of Chipotle's total sales and are dining out less frequently than in the past, Boatwright says. The negative sales trend seems to have continued into the fourth quarter. Chipotle sales dropped by an average of 2.2% a week in the 4 weeks through October 26th, according to Bloomberg data. That followed a 1.1% dip in the prior 4 weeks. Chipotle's stock is down nearly 50%. Much of the drop has occurred in the past 4 months. Fast casual chains and quick-serve eateries are struggling to deliver value as costs rise, says Thomas Paulson, head of market insights for Advan Research, which tracks location and transaction data. Additionally, companies such as Chipotle and Cava Group, a Mediterranean restaurant chain, are fighting quote-unquote premium perceptions among value-conscious consumers and competition from well-priced prepared food options. Bank of America's research has found that restaurant chains are faring worse than independent dining establishments. Spending at chains declined by minus 1.9% year over year in September, more than twice the 0.8% drop at independent restaurants, according to the bank's card data. Quote, it makes sense that independents would skew more heavily to affluent customers because they are more likely to be full-service restaurants and potentially skew to more affluent areas, close quote, says Sarah Senator, BofA's senior restaurants and analyst. Restaurant chains have taken share from independents over time, with the COVID-19 pandemic accelerating the shift, Senator notes. The recent resilience of independent eateries has helped them regain some lost market share. Paulson expects that restaurant margins will be squeezed even more next year, especially among limited service chains. As hiring slows further and costs remain elevated, lower-end consumers and the restaurants catering to them are likely to remain under pressure. And now moving to Fortune magazine. McKinsey alums dominate the world's C-suites. Will AI dry up the firm's CEO pipeline? By Ruth Umo. 4 years ago, Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser shattered Wall Street's glass ceiling to become the first woman to lead one of the big four U.S. banks. But long before taking the helm of the $2.6 trillion financial institution, Fraser was honing a skill set that would quietly define her ascent, one forged not just in the corridors of high finance, but also inside the high-pressure, hyper-analytical halls of the world's most famous consulting firm. Fraser joined McKinsey in 1994, fresh from Harvard Business School, and the superpower she learned there was, quote, problem structuring, close quote. As a young consultant, cycling through boardrooms and back offices, Fraser was trained to break down sprawling challenges, design transformation roadmaps, and rally teams across silos. By the time she made partner in 1997, at the age of 30, she had advised multinational corporations on everything from growth strategy to crisis recovery. It was a crash course in decision-making and pattern recognition across a range of industries. Quote, you learn to structure issues from the ground up, to define what success looks like, and to pull the right people together to get there, close quote, Fraser says. Quote, that way of thinking has never left me, close quote. Fraser left McKinsey in 2004 to join Citigroup. The skills she developed in consulting didn't apply immediately, but over time they became central to her executive playbook. A methodical, systems-driven approach to fixing what's broken, reimagining what can be achieved, and scaling what works, Fraser rotated through critical roles, often in battered businesses, from private banking to Citigroup's mortgage unit after the housing crash. When she was tapped to lead Citigroup Latin America in 2015, she inherited a franchise still dealing with fallout from a major fraud scandal and in need of a cultural and risk management overhaul. Each assignment sharpened her instincts as a fixer and strategist. By the time she ascended to CEO, Fraser brought more than financial fluency, she says. She brought a horizontal approach to leadership, a comfort with ambiguity, and a knack for breaking the messiest problems into solvable parts, the muscle memory of McKinsey. Fraser is hardly an outlier. Across corporate America, McKinsey-trained executives occupy a remarkable number of corner offices. The firm counts at least 18 current Fortune 500 CEOs among its alumni, more than any other company, including Alphabet's Sundar Pichai, DoorDash's Tony Zhu, Lockheed Martin's James Taiclet, and Visa's Ryan McInerney. Add the Fortune Global 500, and that list jumps to 28, with names like Novartis's Vaz Narasimhan and Allianz's Alibaba Bhatt. McKinsey says its internal data shows that more than 500 alumni have held C-suite roles at current Global 500 companies since McKinsey's founding. More than 700 currently hold such roles at companies with more than $300 million in annual revenue. And stunningly, more than half of its alumni over age 40 have reached the C-suite. Those numbers may not be a result of deliberate strategy, but they didn't accrue by accident. For decades, McKinsey has positioned itself as a finishing school for future leaders, where raw talent is shaped through intensity, repetition, and exposure to high-stakes decision-making. The result, when it works, is accelerated judgment and a boldness in imagining ambitious solutions. Quote, you start to believe that more is possible, close quote, says Liz Hilton Siegel, a senior partner and McKinsey lifer. Quote, you build pattern recognition that comes from helping a client do something they didn't think was even achievable, and that builds confidence you carry forever, close quote. The work is demanding, but the payoff has historically been clear, a fast track to influence. And unlike firms that lose track of talent after the exit interview, McKinsey keeps its alumni close. Through invite-only summits, mentorship programs, and informal back channels, it has built one of the most powerful self-reinforcing networks in global business, maintaining relationships long after consultants leave the company and often re-engaging them as clients or collaborators on the other side of the table. But there's no guarantee that this pipeline can replenish itself forever. As with General Electric, a once prolific CEO factory whose dominance has since waned, the question now is whether McKinsey's golden age as a corporate kingmaker can endure, especially as artificial intelligence reshapes the very foundation of consulting. The firm that once trained future executives by immersing them in the world's toughest business problems now faces a future where algorithms are taking on part of the work. Benchmarking, research synthesis, and even PowerPoint creation, once the province of junior consultants, are increasingly automated. That shift is forcing McKinsey and other consultancies to rethink their talent models and their value proposition. No longer reliant on a steady stream of fresh MBAs, McKinsey is hiring more seasoned operators, established leaders who know how to plan for technology-driven change and see it through. At the same time, the Fortune 500's leadership archetype is evolving. Boards are prioritizing executives with deep technical fluency and a proficiency for developing great products and who have led organizations through the messy realities of digital transformation. Historically, McKinsey's alumni have been most concentrated in sectors where its problem structuring muscle mattered most, finance, healthcare, and industrials. Across the Fortune 500 and Global 500, roughly a third of alumni CEOs sit in banking, insurance, and payments, with another sizable share in healthcare and life sciences. Where McKinsey's footprint thins is just as telling. In big tech, the marquee names are few, Pichet and Zhu. Absent are alumni in the top job at Apple, Amazon, Meta, or Microsoft, a cohort that's steadily defining the future of the global economy. That's not coincidental. These firms often elevate leaders who came up through engineering or product ranks and whose credibility comes from building and scaling platforms rather than analyzing them. The strategist CEO, long synonymous with McKinsey, now competes with a rising class of tech-native leaders, many of whom have never set foot in a consulting firm. Still, writing off McKinsey would be premature. The firm, which turns 100 next year, has weathered tectonic shifts before, from the rise of globalization to the digital revolution. McKinsey doesn't just advise companies, the firm says. It teaches people to think in systems, dissect complexity, and lead decisively. The real test is whether that model can evolve fast enough to stay relevant in an AI-powered economy. In the past 18 months, McKinsey has trimmed 10% of its global workforce, largely through attrition and tougher performance management thresholds. The move is being described as a strategic reset, but the scale is large enough to suggest more than mere belt tightening. The firm that helped define corporate leadership must now prove it can produce a new kind of CEO, not just strategists, but architects of transformation. If it can, its grip on the C-suite may endure. If not, McKinsey's legacy as a CEO factory may give way to a new center of gravity that's built in code, not in conference rooms. Inside McKinsey's lower Manhattan offices, one meeting room stands apart. It's a replica of former managing partner Ron Daniel's corner office, a tribute to the man who helped turn McKinsey into a leadership factory. Daniel, who spent 66 years at the firm and was an advisor to the likes of Jamie Dimon and Michael Bloomberg, continued coming into the office well into his 90s before passing away in 2023. It was under his tenure as global managing partner from 1976 to 1988 that McKinsey leaned into its identity as a breeding ground for top execs. Now the firm is reasserting that legacy with new urgency. Quote, "We are creating lots of leaders," close quotes, says Bob Sternfels, McKinsey's global managing partner, the firm's CEO equivalent. Quote, "But is it random, or is there something in the formula and the method?" Close quote. That question is now central to McKinsey's effort to rethink its leadership development model. Sternfels believes the answer lies in a, quote, "diverse meritocracy," close quote, a system that lowers the drawbridge to a broader talent pool while raising the bar for performance once inside. Quote, "It's far less about credentials and far more about potential and raw intrinsics," close quote, he says. Quote, "If you're good enough, you should feel like you have a shot," close quote. And that shot comes quickly. New consultants are thrust into stretch roles, steeped in feedback and expected to develop at speed. Under McKinsey's infamous quote-unquote upper-out model, consultants must make partner, on average, within 6 years or leave the firm. Most leave within a few years, often for prominent roles in business, public service, and entrepreneurship. The firm's 3,000 partners face equally high expectations. Each year, a review committee assesses how partners lead, perform with clients, and contribute to teams, conducting 20 to 30 interviews per partner, says senior partner Daniel Packfitt, a member of the panel. Yet that rigor is paired with reflection. Packfitt often encourages colleagues to consider outside opportunities, not to push them out, he says, but to sharpen their sense of purpose. Sternfels shares this view, noting that he wants employees to continuously, quote-unquote, re-enroll in their McKinsey career. Quote, "In some ways, I don't care how long you stay," close quote, he says. Quote, "What matters is whether you have unrivaled development while you're here," close quote. As client demands evolve and leadership grows more complex, McKinsey is betting that the best way to remain indispensable is to double down on its people. Still, the growth is self-authored. Partners have no direct bosses. They're expected to chart their own course, build their own portfolios, define their value, and maintain lasting relationships with clients. That course very often leads to a corner office. McKinsey tracks the arc of its alumni, and an astounding number of them go on to lead companies. Among those now over 50, about 13% of those who left as entry-level analysts have been CEO of a company at some point in their careers, a figure that represents nearly 1,200 people. Among the much smaller group who attained a senior partner badge, more than half became CEOs. For all the resources McKinsey pours into leadership development, many of its most prominent alumni are quick to clarify that the firm was a powerful springboard to the CEO role, but not the whole story. The corner office came only after years spent building operating muscle elsewhere. Quote, "McKinsey has been everything for me," close quote, says Visa CEO Ryan McInerney, who joined the firm straight out of college. From the start, he says, the firm offered him rare proximity to power and a front-row seat to how decisions get made. In the late 90s and early 2000s, his anchor clients were Bank One and Visa. At Bank One, then a troubled institution, McInerney got to work directly with its new CEO, Jamie Dimon, a formative experience for a young consultant. But when it came time to lead, McInerney knew he had to leave. Quote, "Getting real operating experience was essential," close quote, he says. At 29, he became chief marketing and chief product officer at J.P. Morgan's consumer banking division in an unusually big vote of confidence from his former clients. Later, as chief risk officer, he learned to navigate complexity that extended far beyond a McKinsey slide deck. Quote, "The combination of the McKinsey experience and the operating experience at J.P. Morgan was an exceptional recipe," close quote, he says. Only after he'd run on both tracks did Visa come calling. Cities Fraser made a similar leap. She spent a decade at McKinsey, including 5 years as a partner. quote, "I wanted to actually do rather than just be accountable for advising," close quote, she says. Quote, "I wanted the experience of executing and then living with it," close quote. At Citigroup, she methodically pursued roles that tested her on-the-ground leadership. Her mentor, then CEO Mike Corbett, insisted she spend at least 5 years in a true operating role so she could feel the full weight of the results on her watch. As much as she valued her McKinsey training, Fraser is blunt. She wouldn't have been ready without those years running real businesses. Quote, "Absolutely not," close quote, she says, when asked if she could have jumped directly to Citi's top job. Quote, "McKinsey gave me the courage to be bold, but it was the time spent building businesses, leading diverse teams, and managing complex P&Ls that prepared me," close quote. Bot, the CEO of Allianz, spent 14 years at McKinsey before joining the insurer, where he's now clocked nearly two decades. His consulting years gave him access to decision makers at the highest levels, often far earlier than would have been possible elsewhere. In the firm's fast-growing European insurance practice, Bott found himself as a young principal meeting directly with CEOs of global firms, including Allianz. That autonomy came with a deeper mandate: help clients uncover the real issues, not just fix the ones they assume are to blame. Quote, "You're trying to answer the wrong problem," close quote, he remembers telling CEOs on several occasions. Quote, McKinsey encouraged that conviction to push back, even if the client wasn't amused, close quote. At Allianz, he rose through the ranks, including a stint as CFO, and learned that consulting experience could only take him so far. Quote, "Nothing prepares you for becoming the face of a company. Nothing," close quote, he says. Quote, "Everything that goes wrong is your problem. Everything that really works, you don't get associated with," close quote. Even so, consultants turned CEOs say the firm gave them a powerful foundation. Quote, "The ability to define problems, disaggregate them, and re-aggregate into solutions remains the most important toolkit," close quote, says Bott. At Visa, McInerney says the habits he built at McKinsey still shape how he leads. Quote, "The brutally honest, quick, direct feedback loop and coaching were exceptional," close quote, he says. Quote, "You learn to take it on the chin," close quote. But like Bott and Fraser, he credits the roles in between for his evolution. Quote, "I was certainly more prepared because of the path I took," close quote, he says. In early May, current and former McKinsey consultants packed into a Manhattan restaurant to celebrate the retirement of the firm's former North American managing partner and chairman, Gary Pincus. The guest list read like a roll call of business heavyweights: CEOs, board members, senior executives. Roughly 150 people attended, flying in from around the world. Some were still at McKinsey. Others hadn't worked there in decades. Quote, "It was like a family gathering," close quote, says Packthot. McKinsey's influence doesn't end when alumni hand in their security badges. Its real power may lie not in the sheer number of leaders it produces, but in how tightly it binds them together long after they've left. Today, McKinsey actively tracks more than 65,000 alumni, keeping detailed records of their trajectories and broadcasting their promotions, board appointments, and accolades through newsletters, private webcasts, and curated in-person events. The firm hosts about 180 alumni gatherings each year, and it estimates that roughly 90% of its former consultants engage with at least some of these programs regularly. Quote, "It's about creating resonance," close quote, says Shelley Stewart, a senior partner who also helps oversee alumni engagement. Quote, "Making sure people feel proud of what they were a part of and still connected to it," close quote. But this is more than nostalgia. It's strategy. Leaders of each McKinsey division are expected to own their alumni networks and geographies, nurturing ties that often pay off in future client work. At the heart of that network is a shared McKinsey experience that can outlast business cards and generations. Quote, "When someone becomes a CEO and the stakes are high, they come back to the people they trust," close quote, says Stewart. Quote, "You might have two executives who were 15 years apart at McKinsey, but they get in a room and there's that common bond, a shared vocabulary," close quote. It's an affinity that feels markedly different from alumni networks and other elite industries. Quote, "It's less transactional than what you see in banking," close quote, says Fraser. Quote, "It's more. We know each other, we've learned together, we'll help each other grow," close quote. This alumni flywheel also shapes how McKinsey handles departures. Rather than quietly managing people out, the firm often helps consultants land prominent roles elsewhere, betting that the goodwill will come full circle. Quote, there isn't a single major client situation I'm in where there isn't at least one McKinsey alum involved, close quote, says senior partner Puna Bagai. That dynamic has turned the McKinsey ecosystem into a self-reinforcing loop of influence that embeds the firm's worldview, language, and operating norms deep inside institutions that drive the international business arena. It also serves as a kind of informal governance mechanism. Stewart says he routinely shares firm-wide updates with key alumni before publicizing them, soliciting feedback. The loyalty isn't blind. When McKinsey faced bruising controversies in recent years, from its work with opioid manufacturers to a bribery scandal in South Africa, it was often alumni who raised the loudest alarms. Quote, they care deeply about the firm's role in the world, close quote, says Stewart. Quote, and they will tell us when we fail to live up to the standard we claim, close quote. The fallout from both ethical lapses was significant. The firm's credibility took a public beating, and inside it prompted a reckoning that came with real costs. McKinsey paid more than $1.2 billion in settlements and fines tied to its opioid work, and it agreed to pay almost $123 million to resolve investigations into the South African corruption probe. Internally, partners linked to the scandals departed. At least one senior leader was charged with obstruction of justice. Kevin Snyder, then the firm's global managing partner, lost his bid for re-election in 2021 as the controversy swirled. Sternfels says McKinsey has since invested nearly $1 billion to rebuild its risk and compliance infrastructure, hiring seasoned leaders from companies like Apple and Walmart, overhauling its client screening process, redistributing decision-making authority. The result, he says, is a dual-track ethical framework, one to assess whether the firm should engage with the client, and another to hold consultants to a higher bar of conduct. Quote, I've been very clear that we're going to use these moments to make ourselves better, close quote, Sternfels says. Quote, when you position yourself as an advisor to the world's most important institutions, you lose the right to just shrug when something goes wrong, close quote. As McKinsey works to restore its reputation, it has also been forced to reckon with another disruption reshaping the firm from within. Generative AI. Many of McKinsey's most prominent alumni came up in an era when leadership instincts were forged the old-fashioned way, through whiteboard sessions, analytical modeling, and marathon client management. But with the proliferations of generative AI, much of that early career work is disappearing at McKinsey as well as at its clients. That raises an urgent question. If early career consultants no longer cut their teeth on the hardest analytical tasks, will they still build leadership muscle? Quote, we have to modernize how we develop our people because times have changed, close quote, says Sternfels. That modernization cuts across client work and internal operations. 40% of McKinsey's global portfolio now involves helping clients adopt and scale artificial intelligence and other related technologies. The firm has forged alliances with tech companies, including AWS, Microsoft, Google Cloud, Salesforce, and SAP, collaborating with them on strategy and solutions for clients. In-house, the transformation is even more sweeping. McKinsey has about 40,000 human employees, but Sternfels says the total workforce is more than 56,000, including over 16,000 AI agents. Quote, a year ago, we had 1,000 agents, close quote, he says. Quote, that tells you how fast this is moving, close quote. The goal, Sternfels explains, is to augment human consultants rather than replace them. Quote, we want our people to be superhuman, not superfluous, close quote. That means reimagining the junior-level analyst role from the ground up. Quote, no more PowerPoint production, no more data aggregation, no more basic synthesis, close quote, Sternfels says. Quote, what's left is the creative, discontinuous problem-solving and human-to-human interaction, close quote. It's a sweeping overhaul of how the firm trains and evaluates talent. Historically, McKinsey's internal shorthand emphasized IQ and RQ, intelligence and relationship quotient, as a key to consultant success. In the 2010s, it added quote-unquote capability quotient, signaling the need for deep expertise. But in today's model, AI fluency is non-negotiable. Quote, this is the core capability of the next chapter, close quote, says McKinsey's Hilton Siegel. The transformation is evident in how McKinsey hires. MBAs account for less than 20% of new hires today, compared with roughly 80% when Sternfels joined 3 decades ago. That evolution is testing McKinsey's long-touted apprenticeship model. As AI reduces the need for armies of junior analysts, Fraser concedes that the playbook will need re-engineering. Quote, a lot of that grunt work and analysis helped us build our judgment. We'll need new ways to instill that skill set, close quote, she says. The firm is betting it can stay ahead of the curve by embedding AI fluency across every level. Data and automation literacy are now expected firm-wide, from first-year analysts to senior partners. Engineers are embedded in the client teams, and consultants are tasked with guiding the application of AI to drive growth for clients. The tech imperative is also reshaping how McKinsey defines growth for its own employees. Today, that growth includes learning to part with AI agents and doubling down on the skills algorithms can't replicate. Quote, McKinsey still does high-stakes communication, problem-solving, and offering unique leadership development opportunities better than most, close quote, says Visa's McInerney. Bagai agrees. Quote, the fundamentals haven't changed, close quote, she says. Quote, unless you believe the world will run entirely by AI and robots, those things will still matter, close quote. McKinsey says its newest reinvention is just the latest turn in its enduring mission, shaping not only strategy, but strategists. Packthad points to memos from Marvin Bower, McKinsey's influential managing partner from 1950 to 1967. For now, that ambition endures. McKinsey partners are still on speed dial when boards launch CEO searches, and the firm's longstanding reputation as a leadership boot camp still opens doors. Packthad says he's fielded about a dozen C-suite job offers over the years. Likewise, Bagai and Hilton Siegel have both been approached for CEO roles. Asked whether she might one day consider the corner office, Hilton Siegel shrugs noncommittedly and smiles, sure. Here's a sidebar. Boot camp. Lessons from the CEO factory. The ranks of McKinsey alums who have become CEOs include 28 who presently run Fortune 500 or Global 500 companies. Here are the key lessons such leaders say they gleaned at the firm. Number one, problem solving and judgment. Consultants must master the art of breaking down complex problems into solvable parts and sharpen their judgment through pattern recognition. Number two, exposure and confidence. From day one, new consultants are thrust into stretch roles and given rare access to senior decision makers. Number three, communication and influence. Clear, structured thinking is non-negotiable. And so is the ability to challenge assumptions and align diverse stakeholders around a shared course of action. Number four, owning their own trajectory. A consultant's careers are expected to be self-authored, showing reinvention and range as they cycle across industries, functions, and roles. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name is Greg Conroy, and this has been brought to you by the very good folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Take care. Have a great week.